When we talk about beer, it's usually about the barley or malt flavours. But those flavours are largely driven by the hop plant, whose flowers are used in beer making. The hop harvest in Australia has a pretty short run, with around a 5-week window during which the hops are harvested, kiln dried, and then sent to buyers. And while I can tell you the hops are certainly bare in northeast Victoria, the hop harvest has also gone well at Bushy Park in Tasmania. Our reporter Nick Bosley-Pask took the pulse of the harvest with the Managing Director of Hop Products Australia, Tim Lord.
All up, it went quite well. We're quite happy with the results. We didn't get quite the yields we were anticipating. They were a little bit up and down by variety, which is pretty typical for us these days. Given we now grow far more varieties than we used to, and different hop varieties with different heritages, different parentages, and so they all seem to behave a little bit differently depending on the season. So yeah, some were above expectation and some were a little below expectation. We have focused very much on growing varieties that we've bred ourselves here in Australia. So we've been breeding hops in Australia since the 1940s, 1950s, originally focused just on high alpha acid content, which is the bittering substance that the brewers are looking for in making their beer. And so we've been breeding hops for decades, and the majority of the hops we grow now have come from our own breeding activities. So they've been specifically selected for the growing conditions that we have here in Australia.
With supply and demand with hops, is there a bit of a gamble involved, or do you have a pretty good knowledge of what your market is?
It is a little difficult, particularly in the growing world of craft beer. All the brewers are looking for, you know, that point of differentiation. So with us, you know, we're looking for hops. We're looking to present hops that have high impact in beer, so the brewers, you know, appreciate what we're doing and can get good results, or hopefully that's really their drinkers who really need to respond favourably to that. The difficulty we have is that as we establish new varieties in our gardens on our farms, it takes a couple of years to get them established. So today's demand is not necessarily the same as it is going to be in a couple of years when you've got the hops available. So yeah, there's a bit of a lag there, and it can be challenging at times to make sure you grow what in fact people really want.
Tim, we've talked mostly about the Tasmanian harvest, but you harvest more widely than that. How's that gone?
We also have farms in Victoria, and we've increased those fairly significantly in the last few years. I guess in a nutshell, our production was increased significantly year over year, but it didn't really meet the expectations we have in terms of yield. Victoria had a very damp and humid sort of season, and we found that as we started harvesting the crop, we had very high expectations. The crop actually looked very good. It had grown very well. But as we got partway through, we just didn't get the yields that we were expecting. So we're a little bit disappointed with that. It's come in somewhat under what we expected. But we're still a good increase year on year, and we'll continue down that path for the next few years.
Post-harvest, you begin the cycle all over again. If the weather gods are kind, ideally, what are you looking for in the months ahead?
Well, in the months ahead, what we're looking for is a nice cold winter, to be honest. The hops, as I said, are a perennial plant. They require a nice cold winter for them to go to sleep and go completely to sleep and have those months of dormancy ahead of the spring break. So, yeah, looking into the next few months, we're expecting or hoping we have, you know, relatively normal winter, and then it'll be time to start all over again. Come September, it's interesting. I've just been in the Northern Hemisphere, and everyone's busy starting to grow their next crop of hops just as we're finishing the harvest here. So it won't be long before we're making plans and getting prepared for spring emergence and all the activity that comes with that.
And that's Tim Lord from the Hop Products Australia company. Now, it's been a few weeks since floods decimated northern New South Wales, but many rural industries are still waiting to be assessed and offered compensation. Queensland farmers in a similar position have had Category C assistance declared. That means they can access up to $25,000 to help with their clean-up and recovery costs. The head of the macadamia industry's peak body now wants a quick decision for New South Wales farmers because it's estimated up to 10% of the northern crop has been lost. That's worth around $8 million. The Australian Macadamia Society's Jolyon Burnett told our reporter Kim Honan there's been mixed reports of damage from growers.
Fortunately, most of them seem to rate the damage as slight or moderate, But we do have a few cases of severe damage with trees lost, a lot of erosion and damage to the orchard floor, and of course across the entire growing region, a lot of nut that had fallen to the ground has been washed away and lost forever.
Industry has been quite busy over the last 2 to 3 weeks compiling, you know, damage reports from growers. What are you hearing in terms of damage bills from individual growers and I guess across the board in the Northern Rivers?
Look, it's very difficult to get accurate figures back, particularly early after a damage event like this. But early indications from those who have responded and extrapolating those across the entire grower base is crop loss maybe somewhere around the $8 million mark, and then damage to roads, orchard floor and other infrastructure perhaps around the $5 million mark just here in the Northern Rivers.
And so is that a good case for, you know, disaster assistance from the Commonwealth and state governments?
Look, they're very unfortunate figures. I think the best case for the government stepping up and providing assistance for growers like macadamia growers to get back on their feet is that the rural industries here in the Northern Rivers are a major contributor to this economy. I mean, the macadamia industry alone earns over $100 million in export earnings for the Northern Rivers, just the Northern Rivers. Now, these sorts of events can have a big impact on farms' abilities to continue to generate that kind of economic activity. And the sooner the governments at both state and federal level can commit to some assistance, the sooner growers can begin that clean-up and get back to supporting themselves financially and generating that sort of economic activity, that will be absolutely vital in getting this region back on its feet.
And how soon do they need that money? If it is offered in cash grants up to $15,000, and we're hearing that, you know, primary producers in those areas affected in Queensland by Cyclone Debbie have been granted up to $25,000.
Yes, it's very frustrating to see that damage in Queensland is worth more than damage in New South Wales, and that the livelihood of farmers and the economies they support is worth more in Queensland than New South Wales. Having said that, the support needs to come quickly. In the past, we've waited up to 4 months for a response to a request for Category C disaster relief. By then, it's all over. We need to have a decision on this quickly. The federal and state governments in Queensland have already made a decision and are providing that support to growers as we speak. It should not be beyond the New South Wales and federal governments to make a similarly prompt decision here in New South Wales. So we would expect to see and hope to see a decision by the end of the week.
That's Jolyon Burnett, the Chief Executive Officer of the Australian Macadamia Society. Well, dairy farmers were also taken by surprise by the extent of the floods and had the horrible ability to watch the water levels rise upstream and know those waters would be making their way down to their properties later in the day. It did, however, give them a chance to try to reduce the damage bill and to look after their stock. Dairy farmer Paul Weir explains.
I made the call real early, 8 o'clock in the morning, that it's going to be a big flood. Like, I have never seen rain start about 2 o'clock in the morning, and we were milking in it. I got wet as anything getting the cows in that morning. Torrential rain. When the sun finally came up and we looked out over the paddocks, I've never seen so much water laying, and that's just from local water from the rain on our farm. And so straight away you knew that that's all runoff. Then going home at the breakfast table and then looking at all the river gauges and how much rainfall was in the catchment above me, it clearly told a story that we're going to get wet. We'd had 100 mils by breakfast time here that morning, so it only started from 2 o'clock in the morning to sort of 7 o'clock. Upriver, in two of the three catchments, it had well and truly close towards 300 mils by that stage. And it's got to go somewhere, and you look at the spike of on the technology, on the internet of where how the rivers were rising, and that's all going to come past my farm, and it not only come past, it come over at this time. So when the three catchments, you know, one got over 700 mils for the 24-hour period, the next sort of catchment area got, you know, in excess of 600, and the third one sort of got over 500 mils, and we had probably close to 400 mils here. Well, I tipped out 370 mils in the gauge and it was overflowing, so it's got to go somewhere, and it come down that quick itself that you knew it was going to be big. So we lifted everything that I had control of, we lifted everything up. I had all the cattle up on the hills, all the milkers were at the dairy, the sheds, all my machinery was up, we had that all up, and the lower part of our house, which we had about 30 centimetres in it, we had everything up and just watched it sort of, well, we were lifting right up until midnight and 1 o'clock in the Friday morning. But the only loss I really had that was in my control was probably a $300 little milk pump. From then on, like the damage to the fences, the laneways, the pastures, the silage crops, my molasses tank, you know, went for a swim, probably lost probably 100 round bales. That was beyond my control. We had all those, have a flood ready, or an area that's above previous flood heights, where I had all them stacked, but it just wasn't big enough for this time. When Mother Nature wants to kick your ass gets kicked, and it was my turn to take some this time. But in saying that, though, there's a lot of other farmers who have been worse off than me, you know.
And what do you put the damage bill at? Have you counted the costs yet?
Yeah, probably my biggest loss is my silage crops, and I've been lucky enough to find a farmer who will sell me, you know, so, you know, well, he offered me 1,000 ton. I could buy, we'll buy about probably 500 ton of corn, all going well. So yeah, between that's probably the biggest cost. There's probably going to be 50,000 to 60,000 just to replace the silage crops that I've lost. Then it's the fencing and the laneways. It's probably in excess of probably about 120, 130,000 that will come out of my pocket, yeah, to get the farm back to where it was, you know, 3 weeks ago.
And so how are you feeling, you know, 3 weeks on? You got your drive back yet? How are you feeling emotionally?
Yeah, look, really mixed. My wife, again, one day I'm going to sell the farm, the next day I'm going to, you know, invest more capital in here to make sure that we're right for next time, you know, but It's just frustrating. Once again, it all comes back to industry and what you get, the return you make for your product, and for the amount that we have got invested in our farms and the infrastructure that we have here, and the returns we get out of it, it's nearly criminal. And it's times like this when it really comes home that it's going to take me, I know that for the rest of this financial year, well, and probably for the next 12 months, I will make nothing, you know. So any money you make will just have to go into repairing the place, and it's sort of there's not enough profit left in the milk game at the moment, and we are better off than most, I know that, but still, as the history goes, there's just not enough in it.
That's Paul Weir, who runs a dairy farm at Tuncester, not far from Lismore, speaking with Kim Honan. Now, the clean, green reputation of Australian produce is something we literally bank on. So it was a devastating blow for Queensland's prawn farmers when the white spot disease was discovered late last year. White spot is highly contagious, and it's decimated overseas prawn fisheries by up to 40%. In fact, Australia had been the only major prawn-growing country without the disease. Now, while we've heard a lot about the effect on prawn farmers, less is known about how the outbreak has hurt mud crabbers at Moreton Bay in the southeast. They've also seen their industry crippled. Commercial crabbers are reporting their incomes have halved due to a state government ban that prevents them selling their catch beyond the southeast of Queensland. Like prawn producers, they've lost access to valuable Sydney and Melbourne seafood markets as authorities try to stop the virus's spread. Marty McCarthy has the story.
The Logan River has long been a hunting ground for commercial and recreational fishers alike. Conveniently located between Brisbane and the Gold Coast and accessible by Moreton Bay, the river supports a number of seafood industries. But the outbreak of white spot disease on nearby prawn farms and subsequent detections in the river and the bay has changed that.
In my eyes, the white spot that they've claimed to found in here, it's taken its toll on us commercial guys, and along with the recreational fishers. Even though the river's back open, a lot of the recreational guys aren't back in here for that reason. They're scared of it.
Sean Lothian is a commercial mud crabber based on the Logan River.
Got a nice one in here and a little one.
While white spot is not a risk to human health, it is a threat to the aquaculture sector, and therefore efforts to contain its spread have brought industries like Sean's to a standstill.
This crab's a large male mud crab. He's good quality. He's worth good money to me.
Does white spot present on mud crabs in the same way it does on farmed prawns?
No, you can't visually see the white spot on mud crabs. as opposed to prawns, because mud crabs naturally have a white spot pattern among them.
Whether this crab actually has white spot or not doesn't matter. In mid-March, authorities slapped a movement ban on any crustaceans, including prawns, crabs, yabbies and even worms, caught between Caloundra on the Sunshine Coast and the New South Wales border. The attempt to slow or limit the spread of white spot means fresh product can now only be sold within southeast Queensland. That decision has cost local seafood producers, like Sean.
Oh, it's changed dramatically. Like, for us guys, we used to send a Sydney fish market weekly. Now we can't send down south because of the new movement zone that they've put forward. So we're forced to sell at a lesser price here in Brisbane, and it's making life hard for us.
How much of a lesser price? Do you have an idea of how much you've lost because of this?
Roughly half my income. Like, last year they were $40 or something in Sydney. I think we're flat out getting $20.
How valuable were those Sydney and Melbourne markets, and what has it meant for you to lose those?
Oh, it's extremely difficult to lose them. You know, after years of selling to the guys we do down there, you know, you got a good name and a good market. To not send down there is a huge kick in the guts.
Does the outbreak of white spot damage the reputation of crabbers here, and, as you say, the work you've put into building up that personal reputation with a lot of wholesalers down there?
You know, it's hard to say. Like, you know, if they could lift it tomorrow and say we could send back there, but are the fellas down there going to buy it? Are they going to be scared of the white spot? It's going to be hard for us all around.
White spot can be killed if the product is cooked, but is there no market for cooked crabs and sending them interstate? People want them fresh.
Yes, people prefer them fresh and alive rather than cooked. The cooked market for us is a waste of time. May as well pack up.
And this is your full-time job, floating up and down the Logan River checking pots for mud crabs?
Yeah, mate, yeah. Supports my wife and three kids. I'm finding it hard at the moment, but I'm getting there.
So what are your options? Do you just hold tight until maybe the white spot restrictions are removed, or do you think you'll always be having to deal with white spot conditions here?
Oh, I'm not sure of that, mate. That's got completely up to do with the government. It's nothing to do with me, but, you know, like, those guys can shut us down overnight if they really wanted to.
There are about five other crabbers based on the Logan River. How are they dealing with white spot? Are you all in a similar position, or can you move to other areas to crab there?
We're all sort of in the same position, but a couple of other fellas around here, they got a bit bigger boat than I do, and they can go a bit further.
Is that a frustrating position to be in, to have your hands tied? As you say, you've got a small boat, you can't go to other areas, you're stuck here, and you can't really do anything until the government changes its mind.
Yeah, that's it, mate. That's it in a nutshell. Like, the government control us in some sort of way. You know, they say jump, and we say basically how high. That makes it hard for me.
The public face of the white spot issue is consumers worried about the impact on prawns and prawn suppliers and prawn prices. But what's the personal story for people like yourself who rely on the industry?
We need to survive. For us to survive, we've got to be able to catch and sell crabs. And if we can't sell crabs, what are we going to do?
So how do you adapt with these movement restrictions, assuming they might be there for a while longer? Do you, say, buy a bigger boat, or do you give up altogether and find a job in another industry?
I think I'll just adapt and probably buy another boat. I'll save and buy another boat to go further if it doesn't get any better. I'd go north or south.
I guess it's difficult as well because you know this area and you probably already have your favourite spots, or the spots you know there are good mud crabs in.
Yeah, or everyone has their little favourite spots, and yeah, it's like you said, I know this area pretty well and I'd hate to leave.
That's Logan River mud crabber Sean Lothian speaking with Marty McCarthy. A big thanks to Tim Simons for technical production this week, and you can see some amazing photos of those mud crabs. Very majestic. They're enormous. Just head to the RN homepage and find A Country Breakfast under the Programs tab. I'm Edwina Farley. More great listening still ahead here on RN.